Part 2. The Disinformation Program and Its Impact on the West. 13. The First Disinformation Operation, the Soviet-Yugoslav Dispute of 1958-60. The years 1958-1960 were marked by spectacular polemics between the Soviet and Yugoslav leaders and their party presses, with interjections from the Albanians and Chinese. Khrushchev himself participated with vigor. In his speech to the 7th Congress of the Bulgarian Communist Party held in Sofia on June 3, 1958, he called Yugoslav revisionism a class enemy in the pay of the imperialists and a Trojan horse in the communist movement. Some theoreticians, he said, exist only because of the alms they receive from imperialist countries in the form of leftover goods. The revisionists are trying to bore at the revolutionary parties from within, to undermine their unity and introduce disorder and confusion in Marxist-Leninist ideology, shouts of they won't succeed. The existence of a Soviet-Yugoslav dispute was, to all appearances, confirmed by the boycott of the 7th Congress of the Yugoslav Party by the Communist Parties of the Bloc. By further Soviet criticism of the Yugoslav Party's program and foreign policy, and by the exclusion of Yugoslavia from the 81 Party Congress in November 1960, which condemned revisionism. However, the true picture of Soviet-Yugoslav relations, revealed by inside information supported by much open evidence, is very different. Yugoslavia's final reconciliation with the Bloc. After Stalin's death, the Soviet leaders made a major effort to achieve a reconciliation with the Yugoslav leaders in order to win Yugoslavia back from the West and return her to the communist camp. Official secret negotiations between Tito and Khrushchev in 1955 and 1956 led to a full reconciliation in state relations and a partial reconciliation in party relations. But the process of reconciliation was interrupted by the Polish and Hungarian uprisings of 1956. The initial and generally sympathetic attitude of the Yugoslav leaders toward the Poles and Hungarians during these uprisings, and Tito's attacks on such Stalinist leaders in Eastern Europe as Hoxha, contributed to the surge of nationalism and revisionism in the Bloc and to Hungary's short-lived break with the Soviets. The Soviets recognized the dangers of Yugoslav revisionist influence in Eastern Europe, and therefore resumed their general criticism of Yugoslavia while continuing their efforts to split her away from the West. Although the exchanges of criticism between the Soviets and Yugoslavs intensified immediately after the Hungarian uprising, the leaders on both sides were always careful to leave the door open for subsequent meetings and discussions. After Khrushchev had defeated the anti-party group at home in June 1957, he renewed his efforts to return Yugoslavia to the Bloc. This time he was successful. A complete reconciliation between the Yugoslav leaders and the Soviet and other Bloc leaders was achieved. According to TASS, Kardulj and Rankovich, while on holiday in the Crimea, visited Moscow for comradely meetings with Khrushchev, the Albanian leader, Hoxha, and the Bulgarian leader, Zhivkov, in July. On August 1-2, 1957, Tito, Kardulj, and Rankovich met Khrushchev and Mikoyan in Bucharest for a confidential conference on socialist solidarity. A statement issued after the conference affirmed their joint determination to improve relations and cooperation on a basis of equality. Moscow radio reported that agreement on concrete forms of cooperation had been reached. The major implication of the Soviet-Yugoslavian reconciliation was that the grounds for the continuation of their old feud vanished. It is clear from Yugoslavia's actions in the following months that she had in fact realigned herself with the communist bloc, including China. In September 1957, there were four strong indications of this. A Yugoslav delegation led by Vukmanovic Timpo was welcomed in Peking. Yugoslavia blocked a United Nations resolution condemning Soviet intervention in Hungary. Yugoslav representatives attended a session of Comecon, and Tito, together with Gomulka, publicly repudiated national communism. Said Tito, "We think it wrong to isolate ourselves from the great possibilities of strengthening socialist forces throughout the world." In October, the Yugoslavs honored the commitment they had made to the Soviets in 1955-56 to recognize East Germany. In June 1958, Tito tacitly assented to the execution of the former Hungarian premier, Imre Nagy, whom the Yugoslavs had earlier betrayed to the Soviets. The Yugoslavs secretly attended the first post-Stalin conference of Bloc Communist Parties in November 1957 and openly attended the Congress of 64 Communist Parties that followed it. Significantly, the Yugoslav delegation to both conferences included Kardulj, who had been a Yugoslav representative to the Cominform, Rankovic, who was responsible for the Yugoslav Security Service, and VLA Hovic, who was responsible for relations with communist and socialist parties. At the Bloc conference, Stalin's mistrust of other parties and his interference in their affairs were condemned. New relations between the leaders and parties of the Bloc were established, based on Leninist principles of equality and cooperation. Yugoslavia signed the peace manifesto of the 64 communist parties, but not the declaration of the Bloc communist parties. The absence of Yugoslavia's signature from the Bloc declaration contributed to Western acceptance of the subsequent Soviet-Yugoslav dispute as genuine. However, in his lecture at the KGB Institute in December 1957, General Kurenkov made it clear that the Yugoslavs fully agreed with the declaration but had abstained from signing it because they had reached a secret understanding with the Soviets that it would be tactically advantageous for them not to sign. Among the decisions of the conference to which the Yugoslavs secretly gave their support was the decision to formulate a long-range policy for the Bloc. The agreement that the Yugoslavs should not sign the declaration established the pattern of secrecy and deception subsequently used to conceal Yugoslav collaboration in the formulation and adoption of the long-range policy and paved the way for Yugoslav participation in a joint disinformation effort in support of that policy. From conversations in 1959 with Colonel Grigorenko, the deputy head of the KGB's disinformation department, the author learned that there were consultations and agreements between the Soviets and Yugoslavs in late 1957 and early 1958 on political cooperation between them within the framework of the long-range policy. The agreements covered cooperation in three fields: in diplomacy, particularly with regard to Egypt and India, in Arab and Asian countries generally, in dealings with Western socialists and trade unionists, and in the field of disinformation. According to Grigorenko, early in 1958, the Presidium of the CPCU's Central Committee had given instructions to Pushkin, the head of the party's newly created Department of Active Operations, to prepare disinformation operations on Soviet-Yugoslav relations in accordance with the requirements of Bloc Policy Point 3. This instruction preceded the outbreak of the dispute in April 1958. The dispute manifested itself mainly in the Soviet and Yugoslav party presses. Since in both cases the party press was under the full control of the party apparatus, such a dispute was easy to manufacture and easy to control. Nevertheless, it was clear at an early stage that, in order to capitalize on the operation and build for the future, new assets, channels, and forms of action would have to be developed in coordination with the KGB. This explains why, according to Grigorenko, the Central Committee decided to use, from the end of 1959 onward, both the Department of Active Operations and the KGB's Disinformation Department to widen the scope of this particular operation. As a consequence of this decision, Shelepin issued instructions that a special group should be formed in the KGB's Disinformation Department under Grigorenko to work in cooperation with the Department of Active Operations on the one hand and with the Yugoslav and Albanian security services on the other. Open evidence of Yugoslav participation in the formulation of the policy. Evidence that Yugoslavia accepted the application of Lenin's concepts and the lessons of the NEP period as the basis for the new Bloc policy is to be found in the speeches and writings of Tito and Kardelj during the period of the formulation of the policy from 1958 to 1960. So much Western attention was focused on the polemics between Tito and Khrushchev in mid-1958 that the crucial statements in Tito's speeches, which are fundamental to an understanding of the actual state of Soviet-Yugoslav relations, were overlooked. Tito frequently referred to the relevance of the NEP. For example, in his speech at Laban, Yugoslavia, on June 15, 1958, in reply to Khrushchev's criticisms of Yugoslavia for accepting American aid, Tito said, "The Americans began to furnish aid to us after 1949, as they did to the Soviet Union in 1921 and 1922. Not that socialism might win in our country, but because on the one hand, we were threatened with famine and, on the other hand, Yugoslavia could thus more easily fight off Stalin's pressures and preserve her independence. And if perhaps some American circles cherished other hopes, this was not our concern. For Tito committed himself to a new and broader concept of socialist internationalism that served to protect and support not just the Soviet Union as in the past, but all the communist countries and parties and socialist and other progressive movements. On relations between the socialist countries, Tito said that there was a new confidence and sincere exchange of opinions and experiences on the basis of which broad cooperation is developing. Yugoslavia could play a more useful role outside the bloc than in it. As Tito put it in his Laban speech, refusal to sign the Moscow Declaration and to join the socialist camp does not mean that we are not for the greatest cooperation with all socialist countries. It means, on the contrary, that we are for such cooperation in all fields, but that in the present tense international situation we believe it is more useful to follow a constructive peace policy, together with other peace-loving countries which also do not belong to either bloc, than to join the bloc and thus still more aggravate a world situation which is tense enough. In other words, by remaining formally outside the bloc, Yugoslavia could contribute more effectively to the furtherance of the objectives of the common long-range Leninist policy. Equally illuminating on the true nature of Yugoslavia's relationship with the bloc policy is Edvard Kardelj's book Socialism and War, published in Belgrade in 1960 shortly before the 81-Party Congress. The book attracted the attention of Western analysts at the time because of its polemics against China. In it, Kardelj gives an able exposition of the policy of active coexistence, a concept very close to Khrushchev's peaceful coexistence, and takes the Chinese to task for their negative attitude toward this concept and their opposition to the thesis. Again propounded by Khrushchev, that war is not inevitable despite the continuing existence of imperialism. The West focused on this aspect of Kardelj's book and failed to understand the significance of his recommendation that differences between communists should be analyzed in terms of their substance, not in terms of the verbal polemics between them. The West also failed to appreciate Kardelj's numerous references to Lenin's doctrines, including clear, if not explicit, references to left-wing communism and infantile disorder, and to the experience gained during Lenin's NEP in the use of concessions, diplomatic agreements with adversaries, and various other tactics, in other words, to the same historical sources that were used during 1958-60 in the formulation of the new bloc policy and international communist strategies. The implications of the references to Lenin by the Yugoslav leaders in defining their position cannot be ignored. They clearly established that Tito and Kardelj regarded a return to Leninism and the use of activist diplomacy and tactics in conditions of peaceful coexistence as the most effective way of undermining the nations of the West and changing the world balance of power in favor of the communist countries. Their statements are not only compatible with the long-range policy, they are a clear expression of many of the most important elements in it. They are important evidence that Yugoslav policy and bloc policy as they developed between 1958 and 1960 were identical and had a common source of inspiration in the historical experience of Lenin and his NEP. They also suggest that the Yugoslav leaders made significant contributions to the long-range policy and communist strategy. The possibility should not be excluded that communist strategists from other bloc countries contributed to Kardelj's book. His and Tito's ideas were solidly based on Leninist ideological doctrine, not on the form of revisionism the Yugoslavs had practiced during the Tito-Stalin split. Their concept of active coexistence was but one of the variety of tactics, including Khrushchev's variant of peaceful coexistence and Mao's tactic of protracted revolutionary war, approved by the 81-Party Congress of November 1960. The fact that Tito and Kardelj were developing these ideas during 1958-60 in itself exposes the unreality of their alleged dispute with the Soviets during that same period. It confirms the validity of the inside information on secret Soviet-Yugoslav cooperation. The tactic of publishing Kardelj's book on the eve of the 81-Party Congress, which approved the long-range bloc policy and strategy for the communist movement, recalled Lenin's tactic of publishing left-wing communism, an infantile disorder on the eve of the Soviet adoption of the NEP and just prior to the adoption of new tactics by the Second Congress of the Comintern. A vague admission of the Soviet-Yugoslav cooperation against imperialism over questions on which their positions coincided was made by Khrushchev in his report to the 21st CPSU Congress in January 1959.5. Although the official history of the CPSU, published in Russian in 1959, criticized the Yugoslav leaders for their refusal to attend the bloc conference in November 1957 and castigated the Yugoslav party program of 1958 as revisionist, Sixt also said that normal relations between the USSR and Yugoslavia had been restored on the CPSU's initiative, and that the CPSU's policy of friendship and mutual assistance had triumphed. 7. The reconciliation with Yugoslavia in 1957-58 went far beyond the bounds envisaged by the Soviets in 1955-56. It covered the Yugoslav leaders' relations not only with their Soviet opposite numbers, but also with the Albanians, Bulgarians, Chinese, and all the other bloc leaders. The Yugoslav leaders, in fact, voluntarily surrendered their ideological and political independence to the bloc at the Conference of Bloc Parties in November 1957. This became possible for them because the conference adopted a resolution, which Kardelj and Rankovic no doubt helped to draft, permitting the bloc parties to pursue their own national roads to socialism, provided that they followed the basic principles of Marxist revolution and construction of socialism. Confirmation that all the bloc parties agreed that, for tactical reasons, Yugoslavia should not sign the main declaration of the conference is provided by the fact that, after the conference was over, there was no condemnation of Yugoslavia's refusal to sign by the bloc parties either individually or collectively. Indeed, since November 1957, the real state of relations among all the leaders of the bloc has been excellent, and there has been no basis for any serious disputes between them. The true relationship between Yugoslavia and the rest of the bloc during the period 1958-60 was revealed in November 1960 when the 81-Party Congress, which continued to recognize Yugoslavia as a socialist country, publicly approved, as its most fundamental and crucial decision, a policy manifesto that not only incorporated Tito's concept of broad international solidarity, so heavily criticized by the Soviets in 1958, but also Kardelj's recommendations on the revival of Lenin's activist policies and tactics during a period of peaceful coexistence, and the use of the historical experience of the NEP to facilitate the construction of socialism. There was, of course, no public recognition of the Yugoslav contribution, and the authors of the manifesto were not named. In fact, the Congress officially announced that the Yugoslavs did not participate in the proceedings. Yugoslav revisionism was condemned in general terms in the manifesto. Nevertheless, the evidence of secret agreements entered into between Yugoslavia and the rest of the bloc in November 1957, coupled with the arguments above, points to the conclusion that Yugoslavia's apparent non-participation in the Congress in November 1960 was again no more than a tactical maneuver. The likelihood is that Yugoslavia agreed secretly in advance to the draft resolutions of the November 1960 Congress, and that the bloc as a whole agreed that its interests would best be served by Yugoslavia continuing to appear to be an independent, non-bloc country. Further anomalies in the dispute. Detailed examination of the Soviet criticisms of Yugoslavia in the course of the 1958-60 dispute against the background of the genuine Tito-Stalin split throws up a number of further points that either cast additional doubt on the authenticity of the later dispute and confirm that it was a disinformation operation, or help to illustrate the disinformation technique used in it and the purposes the operation was intended to serve. The dispute opened in the spring of 1958 with criticisms in the Soviet press of the draft of the new Yugoslav party program, which included a statement about Yugoslavia's road to socialism. In fact, the statement was fully in accord with the resolutions of the November 1957 Conference of Bloc Communist Parties. Consequently, Soviet criticism of it was not only strange, inconsistent, and unjustified, but contrary to the endorsement specifically given by the bloc parties of different national roads to socialism, provided that certain basic principles, such as the leading role of the Communist Party, were upheld. Later on, Khrushchev and Tito directly and indirectly admitted that Soviet criticism of the Yugoslav program was unfounded. In his report to the 21st CPSU Congress in January 1959, Khrushchev said, "Questions of the methods and practice of socialist construction are the domestic affair of each individual country. We have no controversy with the Yugoslav leaders on the establishing of workers' councils or other matters of their domestic affairs. When the declaration of the Conference of the Representatives of the Communist and Workers' Parties of the Socialist Countries was being signed, there were no arguments and no controversies on such matters." Thus, Khrushchev repudiated the earlier Soviet criticisms of Yugoslavia's road to socialism, but not before the attention of Western analysts had been successfully diverted by the polemics from what was really going on inside the bloc at that time. Soviet criticism of Yugoslavia for failing to support socialist solidarity was equally unfounded. Yugoslavia's recognition of East Germany and expressions of solidarity with the East German Communist Party and its leader, Ulbricht, demonstrated that Yugoslavia honored the promises of support that had been secretly given to the Soviets. It is noteworthy that neither the Soviets nor the Yugoslavs revealed during the 1958 polemics that they had reached this secret understanding. Officially, the Yugoslav Party Congress in April 1958 was boycotted by the rest of the bloc. But the boycott was strangely incomplete because, although official party delegations from the bloc did not attend, ambassadors from the bloc countries were present as observers. There is room for considerable doubt about the reality of the economic pressure allegedly applied by the Soviets to the Yugoslavs following the 1958 dispute. The Soviets did not cancel agreements or sever economic relations, as they did when Stalin split with Tito. Trade, technical cooperation, and cultural exchanges continued. The Soviets did not cancel their 1956 credit commitments, deny them in principle, or arbitrarily delay the fulfillment dates. Rather, they suggested that there should be discussions about delaying the fulfillment dates from 1957-64 to 1962-69 and 1963-69. In December 1958, negotiations on Soviet-Yugoslav trade began in Moscow, and in April 1959, a cultural cooperation program was signed in Belgrade. In January 1960, the Yugoslav leader Vukmanovic Tempo met Khrushchev in Moscow. At the same time, the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia signed a scientific cooperation protocol. Criticism of Yugoslavia for lack of revolutionary ardor helped to distract attention from the active support later given by Yugoslavia to liberation movements, especially in Africa. Criticism of Tito for accepting American aid, preceded by only a matter of months Soviet attempts to obtain for themselves a $2 billion credit from the United States for industrial modernization. Tito pointed out the inconsistency himself in April 1959, referring to McCoyan's visit to the United States in the previous January. Although Yugoslavia's position in the United Nations appeared to vacillate between support for the United States and support for the Soviet Union, on vital issues such as the German Treaty in February 1959, colonialism, disarmament, reorganization of the structure of the UN, and the ceding of communist China, Yugoslavia consistently supported the Soviet position. There were therefore sound reasons for Gromyko to say that the Soviets' relations with the Yugoslavs were good, and that, on major issues, their positions coincided. 0.9 comparison of the dispute of 1958 with the split of 1948 shows how superficial the later differences were. The 1958 dispute failed to gather momentum. There were no clear breaches in political, economic, or cultural relations. Yugoslavia was not isolated politically by the bloc. Military action was not threatened against her, nor was an economic boycott imposed. There were no major changes in diplomatic representation between Yugoslavia and the rest of the bloc. Exchanges of delegations between them continued. Yugoslavia asked to be admitted to the Comecon meeting in April 1959, but was allegedly refused an invitation. Nevertheless, in the same month, a program of cultural cooperation between the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia was signed in Belgrade. Since details of protocol have often been cited by Western analysts in support of the existence of splits in the communist world, it is worth mentioning that, despite the existence of an alleged dispute, Khrushchev, while on his way to Albania, sent a greetings telegram to Tito on May 26, 1959, which Tito acknowledged on the following day. The final inconsistency in the dispute was the manner of its ending. For no apparent reason, there was a sudden improvement in Soviet-Yugoslav relations in 1960, accompanied by closer diplomatic cooperation. An open reconciliation followed in 1961. The controversial Yugoslav Party Program, which Khrushchev and the Soviet press had criticized so vigorously in 1958 and 1959, and which the Yugoslavs had so obstinately refused to modify, ceased to be an obstacle to good relations in 1960 and 1961. To sum up, open, official information from communist sources confirms the validity of the inside information on secret Soviet-Yugoslav agreements and leads to the conclusion that the Soviet-Yugoslav dispute of 1958-60 was not a repetition of the genuine Tito-Stalin split, but the calculated product of a joint Soviet-Yugoslav disinformation operation in support of the long-range bloc policy, to the formulation of which both sides to the dispute had made their contribution. Once the Soviet-Yugoslav dispute of 1958-60 is seen to have been artificial and once the polemics between the leaders are recognized as having been no more than shadowboxing conducted by agreement between them for the benefit of external observers, the explanation of other aspects of the controversy becomes clear. For example, in response to Chinese attacks on Yugoslavia, the Yugoslav press criticized the Chinese communes. Then, in December 1958, Khrushchev revealed to the late Senator Hubert Humphrey that there were differences between the Soviets and Chinese on the subject of the communes. The following month, in addressing the 21st CPSU Congress, Khrushchev repudiated his own remarks and accused the Yugoslav revisionists of disseminating all sorts of inventions about differences between the CPSU and the CPC. As he put it, "And now the Yugoslav revisionists have taken this fabricator, Humphrey, unto themselves as a witness." Anticipating to some extent the argument of later chapters, this incident can be seen as a good example of disinformation technique. First, Western interest was aroused in non-existent Sino-Soviet differences by a statement at the highest level. Then, Khrushchev's repudiation of his own statements drew further attention to them and suggested that they must indeed have represented a serious indiscretion on his part, which he was at pains to cover up. Apart from its significance in the Sino-Soviet context, the incident provided a further artificial issue with which to fuel an agreed-upon, controlled dispute between the Soviets and Yugoslavs. It was an instance not of antagonism between them, but of cooperation and fulfillment of their secret agreement to collaborate in the disinformation field. Objectives of the Soviet-Yugoslav dispute of 1958-60. The first objective of staging the dispute of 1958-60 was to conceal the true degree of reconciliation between the leaders of Yugoslavia and the other Bloc countries. The reasons for concealment were twofold, bearing in mind the anti-Soviet stance taken up by Yugoslavia in the last 5 years of Stalin's life and Yugoslav sympathy with the Polish and Hungarian rebels in 1956, a sudden open reconciliation with Yugoslavia in 1958 could have had adverse consequences elsewhere in the Bloc, which it was particularly important to avoid during the formulation of a new long-range policy. Bearing in mind also the strength of nationalist feeling in the Yugoslav population and in the Yugoslav party itself, an open surrender by the Yugoslav leaders to the Bloc and to the requirements of its long-range policy could have caused them severe problems with both their followers and their opponents inside Yugoslavia. The second major objective was to prepare the Yugoslav leaders for a special strategic role by building up their image as independents. In the advanced countries, this was calculated to help the leaders to use their relations with European socialist and trade union leaders to promote the formation of united fronts between socialist and communist parties and, in the longer term, to contribute toward the dissolution of military pacts with the United States and toward the neutralization of Western Europe and Japan. In the developing countries, it was calculated to gain acceptance for the Yugoslavs as genuine neutralist leaders of the non-aligned movement, which in the long run they would be able to influence and turn against the West. Subsidiary objectives were to pin the revisionist label firmly on the Yugoslav party and to identify its policies and doctrines as one extreme of a variety of different brands of communism. At a later stage, to project Khrushchev and the Soviet leaders as veering toward Yugoslav revisionism and thereby to assist Soviet activist détente diplomacy in its dealings with the advanced countries, to gain experience, to provide support, and to create a favorable atmosphere for the development of other disinformation operations along similar lines on Soviet-Albanian and Sino-Soviet splits and, at a later stage, on Romanian independence.